This long ban from working also reduces mental health, reduces well-being, because refugees feel more valued if they can work, they want to work.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Integrating refugees is a difficult challenge for hosts, and it's certainly not easy for the refugees themselves. Danny Bahar Brown and Giovanni Perry of UC Davis are two of the authors of a new review which evaluates the evidence on which policies have been tried and the evidence on which policies work best. So welcome to Vox Dev Talks, both of you. Hello, Danny.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And Giovanni as well.
Hi, Tim. It's great to be here.
What is the trend in refugee numbers? Are there more refugees than there used to be?
Yes, certainly the number of international refugees has increased substantially in the last couple of decades. So there are about four times as many refugees, international refugees, now than there were in the early 2000. We have gone from 10 million to about 40 million following the data of the United Nations High Council on Refugees. Also, beyond refugee, also internally displaced people who are refugees inside their own country have grown a lot. And recently, we have about 60 million of them. They're still, to be clear, a minority of international migrants, but their number and share among them is growing.
Why is this happening?
Crisis, conflicts, wars. And in the last decades, there has been actually an increasing number of crises and wars, more wars and longer lasting wars. To create those numbers that I mentioned, there are some specific crises which were very important. The crisis and war in Afghanistan in the last 20 years, in Syria, starting from 2012, the political and human rights collapse of Venezuela since 2015, South Sudan, and more recently, the war in Ukraine since 2022. These specific crises have contributed a very large number of refugees to the world because some of this conflict and crisis and situation of extreme economic need are often also triggered by environmental crisis, by weather crisis. The changing and worsening climate condition suggests that this can become a more frequent event in the future. So growing trend, potentially continuing to grow in the future.
We might be in a period where these waves are becoming more permanent or structural in the world, for which policy solutions need to be also responding to these structural permanent trends, because it's not something that you see a wave for a year or two and then that wave disappears. They tend to be there for much longer. So that was in part the motivation for the review we did.
The two of you live in the United States. I live in the UK. The media narrative around this, and a political narrative around refugees at the moment, is that they are all coming from poor countries and they are all coming to rich countries. It fuels suspicion when this narrative dominates as well. Is this true?
It is not true at all. Looking at the numbers, the largest part of refugees in the world come from poor to poor middle-income countries, and they move in large majority to neighboring countries, to countries which are near them, which also are middle-income countries. I mean, just think about some of the crises. Most of the Syrians went to Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey. Most of the Venezuelans went to Colombia and Peru. Most of the South Sudanese went to Chad and Egypt. Those are local movements. So about 80% of the international refugees are in middle to low income countries, and only 20% of the refugees come to rich countries. I want to add two qualifications to this, though. One is that in the very recent period, there has been an increase in refugees going to richer countries. So the Ukrainian crisis, for instance, had sent most of its refugees to Poland, Germany, nearby regions which are relatively developed in Europe. And the other is that you're right, the attention on refugees, but also in part what we know about integration of refugees often comes more from the one who are in richer countries rather than in poorer countries. So there is a richer debate about refugees in a rich country, to be optimistic. And we also know more about their economic success, integration, and consequences.
Does that difference in how much we know, depending on whether they are ending up in poor and rich countries, maybe distort things? Because it might be a different type of refugee comes to a rich country, or it might be that they have very different conditions as refugees, whether they are living in high or low income situations.
Yes, there are several differences, I would say, in the situation of refugees who arrive to high-income country and those who arrive to low-income countries. In our review, we identify a couple of important and striking differences. First is how the receiving country deals with these refugees. In a poor income country, many of the refugees are in camps for a while, sometimes for a very long time, because this receiving country themselves have economic strain, they have economic hardship. Often, not only they are in camp, but the intervention of international organizations supporting them is crucial. In richer country, refugees instead are often quickly resettled and dispersed, distributed in housing in places with the support of local government and local charity and NGO. The second could be the type of refugee that arrive. To make it to rich developed countries, sometimes you need a level of connection, language ability, education. It's more likely if you have some of this that you are able and are willing to qualify to go to rich countries. So sometimes refugees that go to rich country can be a little bit better educated, speak the language a little bit better. And then the third is that one focus of developed country on refugees is really try to get them into the labor market, to become active, productive, integrated in the labor market. This is really the philosophy and the focus of many of these rich countries. While I would say for the one who arrive in a developing country, the goal is immediate subsistence and just making sure that they have the caloric intake, food intake, minimum amount of needed shelter, food, and maybe assistance for health and the kids that they can have. A lot of these things I said will make us think that refugees in rich countries should have good, better chances of integrating, of being economically successful, while the situation of refugees in developing countries can be a little bit more problematic and complex.
This follows a very simple economic logic. The cost of migrating is going to be higher the further away you are going. So if most of these crises are actually happening in developing and middle-income countries, which tend to be clustered geographically, You would expect that the people who are able to get farther to a developed country will have more resources to do it. And that could be reflected on higher education outcomes or better networks, etc. So I've seen this with the Venezuelan migrants who I've been following very closely. And you actually do see that the ones who made it to Colombia, which is the country next door, they, on average, tend to have good educational outcomes compared to Colombians, but worse educational outcomes compared to people who made it to Chile or people who made it to the US. So the farther away you go, meaning the closer you can get to a developed country, is likely that you are a different type of refugee, which is a very important issue when it comes to designing the policies.
In high-income countries, even people who are sympathetic towards refugees will come back and say, it just costs too much to try and integrate and receive refugees. What is the economic burden on host countries of refugees? As you say, they are a small number within the total migrant community.
This feature that we pointed out, the fact that some of them arriving are the better educated, the one who are more connected, and they are very determined and very strongly motivated to build a better future for themselves, that makes them as an ideal candidate, in a sense, to invest in the receiving country type of skills, language, education, and to succeed in the receiving country. So You correctly said that they are a small number. In no rich countries, they represent more than 1% of the population, 2% at most. So those are refugee, while total immigrant in some of these countries are 12, 13, 15% of the population. They are a small fraction of immigrant. Maybe at arrival, what sometimes generates this strong reaction is that a large flow of refugees all arriving at the same time can feel like a big burden on the receiving country, because at the very beginning, there are some investment which makes sense and seems needed. When they arrive, they do need some shelter. They do need an accommodation. They do need a little time to set up their ability to work, to contribute. So at the beginning, there is some cost. And the more concentrated and the larger is the arrival, the more there could be this reaction of, oh, they are a big cost. In reality, you can think of a few real cases in which there was a big inflow of refugees in the recent years. Syrians in Germany around 2015-16, that's one case that comes to mind. Really, they were more than 1.5 million in a year arriving. That can be big. Or sometimes Venezuelan in Colombia or Ukrainian in Poland and nearby. But vis-a-vis these short-term potential costs, there could be definitely some long-term gains for the receiving country, because these refugees do find jobs, these refugees do get integrated in labor market, do become worker, do become entrepreneur, their kids also often integrate in the society. And so in 5 to 10 years, they become from a potential cost to an asset for the economy. Their economic integration is crucial to how much they become an asset. If they can integrate in the economy fully, and how much they can integrate is going to determine how much they're going to contribute, how much they're going to be a positive asset. And that's why looking at what works in integrating them economically and what are policies that are effective and what are some channel and some approaches that are more profitable on this side is very important in this area. And that's what we do in our overview.
Hi there, Oliver Hanney here, managing editor of VoxDev and the host of our new podcast, Ideas in Development. Over February and March, Dina Musa and I are hosting a series of conversations about the economics of AI. We've talked to Rose Matiso, Raghuram Rajan, Anton Koronek, Josh Lerner, and other leading thinkers and researchers across 10 episodes. To listen to this series on AI, go to the separate Ideas in Development podcast feed by searching Ideas in Development wherever you get your podcasts.
In some situations, we know that refugees are actually prevented from working. They cannot find a job because they're not allowed to find a job. What's the effect of that on integration?
One very important initial consideration is how long does it take to refugees to be able to work, to legally have access to the labor market? Yeah. This is a particularly important question for people who arrive in these temporary humanitarian statuses into rich country. Many refugees don't arrive already as resettled refugees, some do, but many arrive as asylum seeker, temporary protected status. For this group, there are many situations and many cases in which they are prevented by the laws of the country from working in their early period. All the research that we reviewed really seems to emphasize two things. One, the longer is this period of lack of access to the labor market or lack of access to a legal status that sometimes allow you access to labor market, the slower is going to be the integration in the labor market, meaning employment rates and wages of refugees would be lower 5 to 10 years after arrival, long after this ban has expired. There will be consequences from starting late. And what are the reasons for this? Well, is that when you don't have official access to the labor market, there will be uncertainty around your status. Employer will be less willing to hire you. Your human capital will deteriorate if you stay out of the labor market for a while. Employer and refugee will be less willing to invest in learning language, in learning skill in the local area if they don't have access and if they have uncertainty. This seems to be a very important factor. The other thing I would say is that this long ban from working also reduces mental health, reduces well-being, because refugees feel more valued if they can work, they want to work.
And if they are allowed to work, they might not have the appropriate skills for the country that they end up in. Is it a good policy to go around retraining, helping them to find jobs as well with the skills that they have?
That's a fantastic question. I want to start by framing a little bit how we thought about those policies as economists, because a lot of the discussion that could happen in the world is like, there's so much unemployment among people who are citizens of the country. Why should we be putting any resources into this small group of people? That there's intuitively, there's a trade-off there. I'm going to get to the answer to your question, which is yes, we should. We should invest. It's because there are what we refer to as market failures. And these market failures, there seem to be even in certain cases stronger, particularly for refugees. So a clear example of this market failure in terms of labor market is what we call information asymmetries or matching difficulties, matching frictions, which keep a refugee from finding its optimal, quote unquote, employer. Searching for a job is hard. It's hard for everybody, right? Uh-huh. I mean, even if you went to school, had a lot of training, or you didn't, like, it's really not about just opening the newspaper or a website, I guess. It is often about having the connections, about having the idea on how to frame your profile to that job. You have to imagine refugees face those difficulties even more because they often might not know the language. They might not know the network. They might not even know what's the website where you find those opportunities. So that's why these policies, and in particular, the policy of trying to match a refugee to an employer, is really addressing a market failure that is particularly strong for them. And by addressing that market failure, sometimes in very cost-effective ways, can be a really win-win for all, because you will be placing a person in a good match in terms of job, which will be creating a higher welfare for everybody. It makes a lot of sense trying to lower the costs by creating policies, and hopefully policies that are cost-effective, in helping these refugees to match with their ideal employer.
You mentioned language there. Again, I would guess that it's very important to help refugees learn the language and their families as well.
It is. Language classes are one of the most cost-effective policies to integrate refugees. The integration in the labor market, which is particularly hard at the beginning when these refugees don't know the environment, they have a lot of lack of information. They also have sometimes this constraint that they don't have the right skills for a job. All of this seem to be significantly improved by sequencing an intervention that first targets their very basic skills, teaching them the language, teaching them some basic civics. And then many of these labor market matching with the employer help to search are better than after you set up this basic language understanding. Language is also very important because it seems to have a particularly big effect in helping integrate refugees that are farther culturally from the country that receives them. Farther meaning they speak languages which are very different from the local. They have habits which are very different because for them, a little bit of English or Danish or French, depending where they are, will allow them to really be able to access some basic information and some basic job. In the long run, we find that a lot of language classes work well in the labor market because allow refugees to do jobs which have a little bit more of a communication content than just manual content. And these access jobs which are paid better. So just think, if you know zero language, maybe you can be a janitor. Maybe you can be a person who works in basic construction, but you are not going to be able to be, for instance, a caretaker of an elderly person who's a typical job instead, which is done by many of them. It pays better, is longer, is more stable. And this type of career, quote unquote, upgrade can be done with a little bit of language training. So access to better job, better ability to connect with job to begin with and to society are some of the key advantages of language classes. So they are very important.
What about where refugees end up? Some are dispersed throughout the country. Some, as you say, end up in camps in one place. What do we know about the relevance of place?
People, let's say in the US in particular, but I think it's the case in many developed countries, they are actually are often adjust the place they live based on the opportunities because they have access to these opportunities. they might not be as mobile as migrants who are moving, but they actually have access to understand where geographically are these opportunities, because in every country, there are some areas like cities, for instance, that tend to grow more and faster in certain periods than other places. When it comes to refugees, they're often stuck in the place that they were able to get to just when they arrived. And that could be a bordering region where they are in a refugee camp, making the cost of moving very, very high, sometimes like up to the point that it's impossible to move if you're in a refugee camp. Therefore, not being able to consider, like, let's move to this part of the country where suddenly, you know, there's a boom, there's more jobs happening. So that has a path dependence effect. So if you arrive to a place and you cannot move to another part of the country where the opportunities are, you might be stuck in that area, and that actually could result in you lagging behind in your job market for a few years. And the reason that you are not able to move is not only because you don't know, or that you don't know that the opportunities are somewhere else, but also maybe you know, but you don't have the money in your pocket to actually make the move, which is an important constraint that most people don't think about. It. Maybe you just need actually a couple hundred dollars to move. But for a refugee who just arrived, who's severely constrained in terms of liquidity, that could be a big investment. All these policies that we've seen of dispersing refugees to different areas of the country, ideally based on where the opportunities are, and you can think now with the revolution of data and AI, you know, the idea that you can actually help make those decisions even better by really matching the skills of the refugees, that the skills that they supply to areas where those skills are highly demanded, that could really be a game changer in helping this match between employer and employee in terms of refugees.
For all of these policies, whether it's providing cash transfers or education or help for their families or mental health, does it matter who delivers it? Does it matter whether it's a government, whether it's an NGO, whether it's a private project?
We think this is a very interesting and very important question. We also think that we don't know enough about this, I would say, as of now. There are some studies which start looking at a little bit at this correlation, association more than cause and impact, that seem to suggest that the private sponsor that in some country are emerging, so there are some individual citizens that can sponsor refugees. This has been a long time policy in Canada, for instance. In the US is a more recent policy. In Europe is even less used. But there is evidence that this privately sponsored refugee seems to do well in terms of attending language classes, learning the local language, doing well in inserting themselves in the labor market. So we know little and we should know more. But there is one particular consideration that I would add. There is even more need to focus on this. We're going towards years in which governments are willing to spend very little on refugees. The general sentiment, as you said at the beginning, is that why do we spend anything on cost for these refugees? As a consequence, private sector stepping up and private sector providing support and assistance and sponsor can be the only option really for a refugee, and understanding how effective it is going to be very important in such a world.
Maybe the evidence is not there yet, but there's an interesting side effect, quote unquote, of the private sponsorship model that has been growing, and is that almost by definition, you will tend to have more private sponsors wanting to host refugees in areas of the country where the economy is doing better. It could solve two issues at the same time if part of these refugees are actually going to be sponsored by private hosts who are connecting them to opportunities in those areas. And there's a lot of potential there in the private sponsorship, because not only about the geographical location, but also the private sponsors also serving as mentors or as connecting these people to the opportunities. And that's something that is really important in our research agenda in the future years.
One of the most interesting parts of the review for me is what we don't know. It becomes very apparent that we know a great deal more about high-income country settings. Denmark, for example, we know an enormous amount about what's happened to refugees in Denmark than we know about those low-income country settings in which most of the refugees are. Is there evidence that we might misapply our insights because the contexts are so different? And also, if we wanted to close that gap, why is it so difficult to get knowledge of what's happening in those other settings?
Almost in every topic, data in developing countries is a little bit harder to get. It's more costly to have. And that's definitely a limitation in all this research. at least when it comes to what we do know and looking at the effectiveness of these policies, it's very hard to tell whether the policies are just not effective in one place or the other, or that the conditions of that place are so different that make it hard. So what do I mean by this? Developing countries have many more market failures in general. It's hard to know whether these other market failures, like think about informality in the labor market, for instance, or about institutions not working that well, etc., whether is these kind of the binding constraints that is affecting everybody in the labor market and refugees in particular, or is it that these policies are not effective? There's kind of two different ways of looking at it, and it's hard to know. But what I tend to think always when it comes to developing countries, and by the way, we have learned a little bit more, I think, I would say, in the past few years when in all the research about Venezuelans in Colombia in particular, I think that that has really opened a big window on understanding. And in that context in particular, I always tend to think that it would be also unfair to think that refugees could do better than the average person in that country. The informal markets in a place like Colombia are above 50 or 60%, huge numbers. So it is unfair to expect that you will see like Venezuelans in the case of Colombia that are employed 100% in the formal market. That's just not the right standard, right? So I think once we take those things into account, I think it's easier to understand those discrepancies between developed and developing countries in the context of refugees.
Clearly, there's not one policy that's going to solve all of these problems. So also, I guess another challenge is working out which combination of policies delivered in which order and how quickly and for how long works best. How difficult is it to design the optimal policy bundle in any situation?
It is hard. Let me say, you're right. And as Danny was saying, the local context is very important to understand what will work and what will not. And necessarily, the research that we have is country-specific. However, one of the features of economists is that we really want to try to draw some general lessons, right? We don't just study one case to understand one case. We study one case to understand the general principle and rule and mechanism that can work. And the things that we said before about language, I think we have enough evidence to say that language is universally a very important element to learn for the immigrant. Access to labor market, this is also very important. Now, let me say two things about sequencing and bundling. I think that, as we hinted, there is one very important feature that all these policies should have, which is you should intervene early on after the arrival of refugees. You shouldn't sit on 1 year waiting for them to access labor market. Intervene early is number one. The second is if you are intervening and helping with some skill and human capital, it makes sense to sequence first the general, learn a little language, learn a little bit of basic rule, then the more specific, help on the search in the labor market, help with skills that will help you in the labor market. The third is that if you want to help in this initial period, the refugees to invest a little bit in these skills, you should help them out with some cash. Cash support seems to be particularly well targeted early on, when otherwise these people will really be scrambling to just break even and they won't be making this investment. And sometimes we can use in bundling the complementarity of some of these things. For instance, learning a language seems to also put you in a better position, as we were saying before, to take advantage of some jobs. And so being in good labor markets works better if you have a little bit of a language education. So educating and then placing initially these refugees in local economy, in cities where labor market are stronger, seems to also be a nice way of complementing. Yes, there are other specific kind of bundling that we say, but I would say early intervention, sequencing from general to specific, and placing these people in good labor markets so that this some of the skill can reach full potential seem to be important elements.
This is a hard choice as a policymaker, because you also have a budget constraint and you might need to choose. And I think it's really important to keep in mind for a policymaker the importance of diagnosing the problem. Like, what is really the constraint or the market failure that is more pressing for those refugees? And we talked about them a little bit in the paper. It could be an issue about really having a liquidity constraint that they could move if they just have that extra cash. So in that sense, like, those cost transfers could make a difference. If it's really about what we call host-specific, country-specific human capital, These people really don't know the language, but they actually are engineers and they could really add a lot, but the language is a big barrier. So then it makes a lot of sense, these policies such as language and so on. And then you also have this idea of the information asymmetries, matching frictions that these people, for some reason, are unable to connect to the optimal employee. So then it makes sense to have these policies that will help you mentor. And I totally agree that the way we're thinking of sequencing, that's a good framing. There's another important question for policymakers in terms of scale and effectiveness. Because at the end, in many cases, when it comes to refugees, you are dealing with a large population. In the case of Ukrainians in Poland, we're talking about, and in Moldova, like it was a big share of their population, millions of people. In the case of Venezuelans in Colombia also, like we're talking about up to 3% of the population, a huge flow. So then as a policymaker, you really need to think about what of these you can really scale up. It's important to put more thought about how to work out those trade-offs, because maybe sometimes you have no choice but to go for the policy that is really scalable, even if it's not the most effective, but the ones that are really effective, such as maybe having one-on-one mentorship and so on, it's very expensive to put forward. But those are important questions that policymakers need to face when looking at the options on the table.
Is perhaps what really matters at the moment politics rather than economics? We could design the best bundle of interventions, but there is perhaps no chance that they would ever be delivered because they are politically unacceptable.
Yes, certainly all of these policies are decided by politicians ultimately. And as we said, right now in the US, in Europe, the general attitude is that of considering cost of refugee as something where they don't want to invest. However, I am a big fan of simple rules. So even if the politician don't take the more complex analysis, the two or three pointing out that language classes are super cost effective and they return their investment quickly, preventing these people from working is bad both from an economic point of view because they will not contribute and for their integration. Taking a couple of simple messages that have almost cost zero will be important. As much as governments are becoming less maybe willing to do that, the private sector and in particular employers are realizing that rich countries are becoming very quickly scarce of workers. The needed resource now are workers. Our population are shrinking. Very few people will do those jobs. And they could be instead the main listener in this type of idea, because what we say very often is that the employment and the integration of these people is also what makes them productive for you, employer. A good match with you is good for them and for you. So maybe we will switch a little bit to have listeners who are private sector and employer, and we will say very simple things that can be implemented.
That's a fantastic point. I mean, the labor shortages, I think, are the most pressing and neglected issue over times. There's other pressing issues such as climate change, but it's not neglected. People have opinions, people talk about it. But this demographic shift we're living in the world where rich countries are having essentially a lot of jobs, but no people, and then developing countries having a lot of people, but no jobs, the solution seems to be obvious. When we start feeling at the very local level that this is not a favor to anybody, but there's no nurses, you need the nurses, you need the people to work in the elderly facilities, you need the truck drivers. In our models, we call labor just an L and everything fits in there. But the reality of the world is that there's much more complementarity. A truck driver, it's helping this neurosurgeon to do his or her work. And the neurosurgeon needs the nurse, and the nurse needs the cook in the restaurant. So we all are complementary to each other. And therefore, when one piece of that puzzle is missing, we need to act. And I think migration here is really an important tool. Even though, in general, we do see that a lot of backlash in terms of refugees and migrants, we have seen some examples of politicians who have stood up and have understood this and taking a political capital cost to what they did. And an example is what we've seen in Latin America. I do think Latin America stands out with this Venezuelan refugee crisis and where many countries, and maybe Colombia with President Duque, the former president who was at the frontier of pushing for a massive program of giving regular status to millions of Venezuelans. I think that we have these cases of politicians who are willing to look at the evidence and do the right thing and then show how this has actually benefited their countries. So hopefully we're going to be seeing more of that as we start to internalize the benefits that this could bring to us. It's not about pity. is about our own self-interest.
I hear your optimism, and let's hope that it's justified, because there are huge problems to solve here, but a huge benefit if we do. Thank you very much, Danny and Giovanni.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
The paper is called Refugees Economic Integration, and the authors, Danny Bahar, Rebecca Bruff, and Giovanni Perri. It is forthcoming in the Journal of Economic Literature. If you want to read the working paper version, longer title, Forced Migration and Refugees, Policies for Successful Economic and Social Integration. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. Best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, you know what I am going to say, subscribe. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, at voxdev.org, where there are articles about topics like this. And if you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us. Leave us a review. It's only a couple of clicks. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zalgarian. Thanks to Oliver Hani and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.